Let me remind you of where we are in the bigger scheme of things. At first, we developed the mathematics to describe curved space-time. And then we investigated how matter fields evolve in curved space-time. The Klein-Gordon field, electromagnetism, the Dirac equation. And then we investigated how these matter fields create contributions to the energy momentum tensor. So locally, we have an energy density, momentum density, caused by the various fields that live in the space-time. And we are interested in this stress energy tensor or energy momentum tensor, T mu nu, because, as we will see, it will be crucial, a crucial part of the Einstein equation that determines the dynamics of the space-time. So then, once we have the Einstein equation, which is what we will arrive at today, we will have gone full circle. We will have studied how a curved space-time is affecting the motion of matter in the Dirac equation, the Maxwell equation, the Klein-Gordon equation. And once we know how the energy momentum tensor of matter curves space-time, we have both directions. How curvature affects matter, how matter affects curvature. Okay, so today we will study some more the energy momentum tensor, and then we will derive the Einstein action. We will derive, therefore, the Einstein equation. You may wonder, what deriving? Isn't that something postulated? No, there is one legal way that you can derive the Einstein action and the Einstein equations from something that doesn't require any further assumptions other than standard physics. The argument is actually almost half a century old and very beautiful and quite insightful, so we will do it. Okay, so first we continue with some insights on the energy momentum tensor T mu nu. Remember how T mu nu was defined. T mu nu is the derivative of the action with respect to changes in the metric. So you take your matter action, so the S is the action for all of the physical fields that we know of, and in principle those that we don't know of, but know that they exist, like dark matter. We have no idea what it is, but it's out there, and it's most of it. Most of what is out there is dark matter. So the energy momentum tensor is defined as that tensor here, which makes that equation true, which is to say that it's the derivative of the action with respect to the metric, right? Because it's ds by dg, dg, right? Okay, so that's how we define the energy momentum tensor. We also had to put the square root of g in here because otherwise we got the energy momentum tensor density. But if you want the energy momentum tensor, we have to put the square root of g in here. Okay. So this is the mathematically rigorous form of what you usually find in more sloppy notation. In more sloppy notation, people would say T mu nu is the derivative of the action of all matter fields in nature with respect to the metric, times 2 divided by square root of g. But what is the functional derivative of S with respect to the metric? Well, it's what makes this true, where this is a variation of the metric in some region B. And here we have then that T is, you know, ds by dg, ds by dg, dg, so it's really ds. Okay. And we also showed that the energy momentum tensor is covariantly conserved, which means that if we do the covariant derivative in the nu direction and then sum over nu, this is zero. And we found that this always holds. This is a consequence of the freedom to choose coordinates. This is a consequence of diffeomorphism invariant. Therefore, it is not a physical statement. It is not actually a conservation law. It's still very important to know, though. Okay, so then we said that, as I said, this equation here, this so-called covariant conservation of the energy momentum tensor, is not really a conservation law in spite of the name. And the reason is that T mu nu semicolon nu square root of g is not a divergence. Although it almost looks like one. See, if you have a contravariant vector that has just one index up here, as opposed to the energy momentum tensor that has two contravariant indices, if you had only one contravariant index up there, and then do the semicolon mu and sum that over, multiplied with square root of g, this is, if you remember, a divergence. And divergences can be integrated up, and we get a conservation law. Okay, so it's not a divergence, except if spacetime possesses isometries, or an isometry, then we can derive a conservation law from the energy momentum tensor. Now, what does it mean that a spacetime possesses a symmetry? It means that the spacetime doesn't change if we do something specific to it. So, for example, if you have a vase made out of glass and it is rotationally symmetric, then you can take that vase and rotate it by an arbitrary angle and you get the exact same shape. What this means is that the metric tensor doesn't change even though you do something, right? You rotate the whole thing, metric tensor doesn't change. The infinitesimal version of that is the Lie derivative. So the Lie derivative acting on the metric is zero, means the metric has a symmetry. If you took your vase and you turned it this way around, or you did some other funny thing to it, then you would change the shape. But if it has a rotation axis and you rotate around that, then it stays the same and the Lie derivative of it is zero. So if the Lie derivative of the metric is zero for a particular vector field psi, remember the vector field psi induces a flow on the manifold, for example, the flow around the vase, right? Then if the Lie derivative in the direction of that flow is zero, then this differential equation holds, because this differential equation becomes that differential equation if you just write, spell it out. And then we have that we can take the vector field that generates the flow along which the metric doesn't change, this vector field psi, the so-called killing vector field. We can take that, contract it with the energy momentum tensor, and we get a four vector that obeys a conservation law. Namely, we can take this four vector and calculate its covariant derivative, its divergence, and it comes out to be zero. But whenever you have a quantity with just one upper index, so not the T mu nu, but a quantity with one upper index, and then contract it with its covariant derivative, multiply with square root of g, then this, by some results that we had some lectures ago, is actually the divergence of that vector field. But the divergence is the anti-commutator of the exterior derivative and the inner derivation. And if you take di plus id, then the id term goes away, because the d, the exterior derivative, acting on the volume form, being a full form, being an n form, is vanishing, because the d applied to the volume form would have to be an n plus 1 form. Doesn't exist on an n-dimensional manifold. Right, so this is a divergence, and we can use Stokes' law, or Gauss's law in this specific case. It's also called Gauss's law. And then this integral over a volume becomes an integral over a boundary. And then that gives us a conservation law, because what flows, the total flow over the boundary is zero. We will get into examples of this later on in this course in much greater detail. Now, how many conservation laws can we get? Could it be that if we are lucky, we find a space-time that has 394 killing vector fields? Wouldn't that be great? Because then we don't have to bother solving differential equations. You know, we just have lots of conserved quantities. No, we can't have that. Well, it depends on the dimension. If space-time was a million dimensional, then we could have that. But no, space-time apparently has only 3 plus 1 dimensions, as far as we know. And it turns out that then the maximum number of independent killing vector fields that we can have is 10. 10, as you will see. As I said before, the actual space-time in which we live has no killing vector fields, because there's us, there's stars, all of that stuff is changing. The space-time makes it non-symmetric. Okay. Now, we will get into killing vector fields later on in much more detail when we talk about cosmology, because in cosmology, we can make use of a whole number of exact solutions of the Einstein equation. And these exact solutions can be characterized by the number and character of killing vector fields that they have, by the number of symmetries that they have. You're probably familiar with the FRW spacetimes, which have a very large number of symmetries, you know, rotation and translation symmetry. But cosmology can also be solved with other solutions that are not simply FRW, and they are in a way more interesting because, for example, there are solutions known where the spacetime is expanding in some directions and shrinking at the same time in other directions. And because gravity is highly nonlinear, these two will interact with each other. You would never see that if you just looked into FRW solutions. Anyway, we will get back to killing vector fields when we classify solutions to the Einstein equations according to the number of symmetries that they have. Obviously, the fewer symmetries you assume, the harder it is to solve the Einstein equation. All right. So let us look at some more things about the energy momentum tensor and its killing vector fields before we there's just a few more items that we will cover before we finally derive the Einstein action and Einstein equation. Now, intuitively, there should be space-times that are stationary, which means space-times in which there is a translation invariance in time. For example, the Schwarzschild solution or Minkowski space. They have translation invariance in time. Nothing really changes in time. And you would expect that Noether's theorem still applies, which means that the translation invariance in time implies a conservation law. And of course, we would call that the conservation of energy. Such space-times are called stationary. So the definition is a space-time defined by a manifold and a metric on it is called stationary if it possesses energy conservation, which is to say, if it possesses a time-like killing vector field, that is to say, if it possesses a field xi, which obeys that it's a killing vector field, the Lie derivative is vanishing of the metric in the direction of that killing vector field, and such that xi mu is smaller than zero. This means it's time-like, right? Because the signature of the metric that we use here is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And so in order for a vector to be time-like, the length of it has to be negative. The length square of it has to be negative. And why would we want our killing vector field to be time-like? Remember, a killing vector field is a vector field whose flow is such that the metric doesn't change along that flow. So if you want to express a symmetry which says that the metric doesn't change in time, then there must be a killing vector field that is time-like, so that the flow that it generates can be interpreted as a time. If we choose a coordinate system in which the time variable, if the killing vector field is time-like, then we can choose a coordinate system such that the t variable has a dt, which is a vector that points into the direction of the killing vector field, actually the dual of it. Okay, so since xi is a time-like vector, a killing vector, as we assume, observers can, in this case, if that exists, observers can travel along the integral curves of our vector field, the vector field pointing into the future. It gives us the time direction, right? It literally gives us the direction in which time points in four-dimensional space. So we can, given a time-like killing vector field, we can set up a coordinate system with the proper time being the time coordinate. a coordinate system which flows along with where the dt is parallel to that flow that the time-like vector field is generating. Such a coordinate system is called co-moving, and mathematically it is distinguished by being chosen in such a way that it's our time-like Killing vector field takes the form 1, 0, 0, 0. You see, only time-like vector fields can be put into that form. All right, now the condition that our vector field is a Killing vector field means that the lead derivative is vanishing, which is to say that the metric doesn't change in the direction of the flow, which is to say into the future along the time. This condition that the lead derivative is vanishing can be written in this way. Remember that equation, that's the lead derivative for a tensor that is twofold covariant. We start out with the ordinary derivative and then of the tensor that's being differentiated, and then we get the derivatives of the vector in whose direction we are differentiating. If you remember last time we saw that equation, we wrote it with a semicolon for convenience. But we don't have to, because it's true with and without semicolon. Remember, we actually derived it before we had introduced the metric or an affine connection. So clearly that must be true anyway. And then with the usual argument that at every point we could go into a Riemann normal coordinate system where the commas can be replaced by semicolons, but once you have it in semicolons, it must be true in all coordinate systems. Okay, so from this, we can now deduce the following. Since we have anti-symmetry here, because this is a Killing vector field, we have that is vanishing, and we have that simply the time derivative of the metric is vanishing now in this coordinate. Sorry, no, it's not because of anti-commutativity. That would be true if this were semicolons, it's ordinary commas. Now it's true because the components of the xi vector are these. And if you differentiate them, because it's constant, this is zero, that is zero. We're just left with this. But because this vector has only 1, 0, 0 here, we have only the g mu nu, comma 0 component surviving, which is to say the time derivative of the metric is zero. So what we see is that indeed that the metric is constant in time, literally constant in time according to co-moving coordinate system. And we can always achieve that if we have a time-like Killing vector field. Now, in statics, just a sec. I made a mistake, sorry. Yeah. Okay, so in stationary space times, so what this means, I wrote here static, it shouldn't be. This should be stationary space-time, because we are talking about stationary space-time so far. So in stationary space-times, we can therefore, as we just saw, always find a coordinate system such that the metric is literally constant in time. It might have a complicated spatial dependence, but it's constant in time. And this means that co-moving observers, that is to say, observers who are addressed with respect to a co-moving coordinate system, those who travel with the flow generated by the time-like vector field, see no change in the prevailing local curvature, because for them the metric is literally constant. Now, if a metric is stationary, it doesn't mean the same as if the metric is static, even though I interchange. I have to fix the typo over there. You see, you can require more of a metric than only that it is constant in time. You can require also of the metric that it can be put into the form something here, something there, and then zeros here. So you can ask for the metric to also be block diagonal. Now, why would that be a special case? Where could that occur? Remember, stationarity means the space-time is always the same one. Does that mean nothing happens gravitationally? For Schwarzschild black hole, certainly. For Minkowski space, certainly. Nothing happens there. It's just the same metric, and it's just sitting there. But could it be that we have a situation where the metric is stationary, so it's constant in time, but something is happening, gravitationally speaking? That can happen, for example, for a rotating black hole. If a black hole is rotating, then the metric is the same, it's constant in time, but still it's swirling, so to speak. And it's just the intuition of it. The mass of it is that the metric cannot be put into this form where it's blocked diagonal, where space and time are completely separate. Right here, if you have zeros here and there, it means that the time components live their own life and the space components live their own, and there is no mixing, no curvature between the space and time coordinates. So for rotating black holes, for example, we will have stationarity, but it's not static. So a space-time is called static if the time-like Killing vector field psi that had to exist in order for the space-time to be stationary, if it also obeys this equation here. So if we take our Killing vector field psi and view it as a one form, this is just the coefficient functions, and then these are the basis vectors, so this thing itself is a one form, then we can calculate the wedge product of this one form and that two form. The whole thing is a three form. If that thing is vanishing, then one can prove, and I invite you to do it as an exercise if you like, one can prove that if and only if that is true, then our metric is not only stationary, then it's also static. Then our metric can also be written in this block diagonal form where space does its own thing and time does its own thing and there's no mixing between them. So this would rule out rotating black holes, but allow for non-rotating black holes, for example. Right. And so here I'm just saying that, yeah, you can prove both directions, but I will skip the proof of two directions because we have much more interesting things later in this hour when we derive the Einstein equation and the Einstein action. All right. So a little bit more before we get to the Einstein equation, a little bit more on general properties of the energy momentum tensor that we will need later on. And since we are dealing with the energy momentum tensor now, let's just cover that material as well. So the energy momentum tensor, as I said, has contributions from all known and also from all as yet unknown matter fields, for example, from dark matter. Everything, whether we identify it or not, will have some energy momentum tensor. And that's how everything interacts with gravity. For example, dark matter, we cannot see. We have no idea what it is, even though it's like 80% of all the matter in the universe. We don't know what it is, but we know it exists because it produces an energy momentum tensor. It produces a contribution to the energy momentum tensor, and that contribution gravitates. That's what we see. The rotation behavior, the way that galaxies rotate, would be very different if there wasn't dark matter around. So what can we do, given the fact that of most of the dark matter, we don't know what it is. Of most of the matter in the universe, we don't know what it is. Right? So we can see what is in planets and what is in stars, but that's by far the minority of the matter that there is in the universe. Most of the energy momentum tensor is not. The origin of it, we don't know. Still, we need to draw some conclusions from the energy momentum tensor, so we have to make some assumptions about it. These assumptions are very important if, for example, we want to derive whether or not a black hole has to form or not. When a black hole forms, it's because matter collapses. But we should not need to care whether this is dark matter or visible matter. It's just matter. And so it can pile on and contract and then form a black hole. So what we need in order to derive black hole singularity theorems or theorems about the existence or non-existence of a singularity at the beginning of the universe, the so-called cosmological singularity, we don't want to treat every case of an energy momentum tensor separately. That would be too much work to do. No, we want to be able to say something like, if the energy momentum tensor is of this general class, well, then a black hole solution is unavoidable. This stuff must collapse and form a black hole. Or if the energy momentum tensor is of this kind, this generic kind, then the universe must have had a beginning and a singularity. That's the kind of theorem that eventually we want to cover. And so we want a criteria to say this kind of energy momentum tensor or that kind of energy momentum tensor. And here are some of these criteria that are most often used. First of all, the weak energy condition. The weak energy condition is a condition that you can pose under the energy momentum tensor, and then you can say any energy momentum tensor that obeys the weak energy condition leads to such and such physical behavior, and so on. Right? That's the overall structure of what we want to do. So what is the weak energy condition? The weak energy condition is the T mu nu contracted with a vector field V is larger or equal to zero for all time-like vectors V. What does that mean? Well, all observers travel with a time-like tangent, right? Because observers can only travel into the future. Observers can only travel on time-like trajectories. So the tangent vectors to the trajectories of observers are always time-like. And then what this is saying is that if we choose an observer who is therefore traveling on a trajectory with a time-like tangent, then if we apply that tangent here to the energy momentum tensor, this is positive. What does that mean? Well, go to the rest frame of your traveling observer. In the rest frame, the velocity vector is what? 1, 0, 0, 0. Because if you are at rest, you're still traveling, but only in time. That's the 1, right? So 1, 0, 0, 0. Which means you're really looking at the 0, 0 component. In the rest frame, the 0, 0 component larger than 0. Which is to say that if you are on a time-like trajectory, if you are an observer and you look in your rest frame at the energy momentum tensor, then the 0, 0 component, which is the energy density, the rest is stress or momentum. The 0, 0 component of the energy momentum tensor has to be larger than 0, so the weak energy condition says the energy density better be positive for all observers at rest. Okay, so that is a fairly reasonable assumption. You can't prove all that much with it, but it's a fairly benign assumption. And then there's the dominant energy condition. And the dominant energy condition is the following. It says our T mu nu should obey the weak energy condition. Here it is again. And it should obey another condition as well. And that condition is that this vector that you obtain by contracting your velocity vector as an observer with the energy momentum tensor, this vector should be time-like or null. Now, why would we want that? Do you remember what that is if you take the energy momentum tensor and you contract it with a vector? Remember what that is? If this vector is a Killing vector field, then that is a conserved quantity there. That gives you a conservation law. This could be energy or momentum, depending on whether this thing is time-like or space-like. So this quantity here, this k mu, may be conserved. It depends on whether the V is actually a Killing vector field. If you travel as an observer along a Killing vector field, you get a conservation law. So this may be a conserved quantity. So therefore, Depending on what the V is, you know, this could be an energy flow, this could be a momentum flow. But remember, in general relativity, energy is generally not conserved, only if there's Killing symmetry. Momentum is generally not conserved, angular momentum, generally not conserved. But this K mu is a quantity that can play, take these roles. So the K mu is always something like an energy flow, something like a momentum flow. And this statement here says, this statement says that this flow is time-like or null. So the dominant energy condition says energy and momentum may or may not be conserved, but they can only flow into the future or, I mean, inside the light cone or on the light cone. But energy and momentum are not supposed to flow outside the light cone. You see, if this vector here, which can denote an energy flow or momentum flow, if this vector had a positive length, it would mean it's space-like, which means it's a flow that is superluminal. It's flowing faster than the speed of light. So since we want the flow of energy momentum to be causal, we want that energy momentum flow to be inside or on the light cone. So this K squared better be either light-like or time-like, but not space-like. And it turns out that that condition, that the flow is always inside or on the light cone, can be rewritten in an orthonormal basis simply as the statement that the zero-zero component, which is the energy density, has to be larger than any one of the other components, like the momentum of our energy momentum tensor. Which is why there is the name, the dominant energy condition. Energy here dominates over momentum. These are momenta, this is energy. So the dominant energy condition says that the energy has to dominate over the momentum. Why the absolute values? Well, momentum could be positive or negative. It's the magnitude of it that matters. Okay. Now, finally, we get to the dynamics of space-time. Close the loop. All right. Let's see. Consider the full matter action. So S is the action that contains all of the fields of nature that we know of or that we suspect exist because of dark matter. All of them. And of course, the metric will also be in there, because we need it for the covariant derivatives in the action, and so on. So let's consider the full matter action. There's a Lagrangian here. The action always takes the form of some integral over some Lagrangian, and then here the volume form. So this is the combined theory of gluons and neutrinos and electrons and quarks, the whole shebang. Then what are the equations of motion? Remember, we said the classical equations of motion are derived by functionally differentiating, by varying the action with respect to each one of these field species, each one of the fields of a particle species. The I was an index for the species of particle, like electrons or neutrinos. And that has to be zero. We have to do this for all of the fields, and then we get a bunch of equations of motion. They all take this form, where we have the L by the covariant derivative, and here another covariant derivative. These are the Euler-Lagrange equations that you've seen many times before, but now they are covariantized. Okay, so far so good. Now let's try to pull off the same trick for gravity and see what happens. Now we take the action, the same action as before. It's the action of the electrons, the neutrinos, the quarks, the gluons, the whole thing. And now we say, let's differentiate with respect to the metric. The only thing we haven't differentiated with respect to yet, right? The previously the equations of motion were obtained by differentiating with respect to all of the matter fields. And then we get the equations of motion for electromagnetism, the Dirac equation, all that. But there's also the metric in the action. And if we differentiate with respect to the metric and set that equal to zero, do we perhaps get the Einstein equation? Let's see, what do we get? We don't get the Einstein equation. You see, if you differentiate the matter action with respect to the metric, you get what we've already done. We know what it is. When you differentiate the action with respect to the metric, you get 1/2 energy momentum tensor square root of g. And if you set that equal to zero, well, then you're simply saying the energy momentum tensor is zero. That would be bad news. We wouldn't exist. Because where we are, we've got to make energy and momentum, right? So no, that can't be the right thing. So it's a weird scenario. What we have is a perfectly fine action, the action from the standard model of particle physics with all of the known fields in it, and it includes the metric. We get the proper equations of motion for all of the fields of nature, except if we functionally differentiate with respect to the metric, as we did for the other fields, and set that equal to zero, we get nonsense. We get informed that there's no energy. Can't be right. So what has to give? Well, what has to give is that maybe something is still missing up here. You see, maybe the action from the standard model is not enough. Remember, this was the action composed to describe particle physics. This is the action that contains the action for the electrons, the neutrinos, the quarks, the gluons, the Higgs field, all of that stuff. But there's no term specifically for gravity in there. So what we should expect is that there is at least one more term in there in the action that we need to add, so that when we then do the derivative, we get two terms. One term is going to be the energy momentum tensor, and the other term is what we get if we differentiate the new entry here, the newcomer to the action with respect to the metric. And so we would expect that if there is an extra term in the action, a gravitational action term, if there is an extra term, then setting the total action's derivative with respect to the metric equal to zero gives us an equation of the form energy momentum tensor plus some other thing equal to zero. That would be then the equation of motion. And the other thing is the derivative of the new term with respect to the metric. But how can we guess what the extra term should be? It would have to be, if there's one term, it could also be that there are two, three. Truth is, there are infinitely many. And that's a problem. But most of them are super duper tiny. How would we derive what other terms there should be? Now, I could just tell you what they are, but then that wouldn't be very satisfying, right? So I won't just tell you what they are, let's derive it. In fact, in 1969, Andrei Sakharov, famous Russian physicist, wrote a paper, half a page long, in which he explained that. And it's ingenious. And if Einstein hadn't found general relativity, at that point, Sakharov would have. Because while Einstein was guessing correctly with an enormous amount of ingenious intuition, Sakharov actually derived it from something that Einstein didn't have available at the time. He derived it from quantum field theory. So basically, we can now derive the Einstein action, and therefore the Einstein equation, from something that is not controversial. We can derive it from quantum field theory. We know that quantum field theory is a good theory, because it predicts like the lamp shift of in the hydrogen atom to like a dozen digits behind a comma. It's not an assumption that quantum field theory is good. It is good. We know that for sure. Right? And from just quantum field theory, we can derive the Einstein action. So let's see how that works. Oh, it was in 68, not 69. So Andrei Sakharov started out with the following argument. And you will see I'm saying more than half a page. So this is an expanded version of what Sakharov wrote. Okay, so Sakharov started out with this observation. The quantum effects of matter induce suitable extra terms in the action. So you see where this is going? The quantum effects of matter are the origin of gravity. Okay? Let's see how this works. Maybe I give you a little bit of a bit of a background. Imagine you take a classical system and you look at the equations of motion of its observables. Equation of motion of position, momentum, and so on. And then you look at the quantum version of that system, and you look at the equations of motion of its expectation values of position, expectation values of momentum. And then you can ask, both are number valued, right? Position, expectation values are number valued, just like actual positions in classical physics. And for the momentum, the same thing. And you can ask, are they the same? Are the equations of motion for position and momenta of the classical system the same as the equations of motion for the expectation values of positions and momenta of the quantum system? Anybody know the answer? Sometimes they're the same, but very rarely. Usually they're not the same. You know an example where they are the same? Harmonic oscillator. For the harmonic oscillator, the expectation values behave exactly the same way, the quantum expectation values, as the classical positions and momenta. But that's just because the harmonic oscillator is so simple. It's also true for coupled harmonic oscillators, as long as they are just linearly coupled. But as soon as you add some nonlinearity to it, as soon as you take some term that has x to the third in it, or something like that, or x squared p squared, or xpx, or something, that will destroy it. And then we are in the generic scenario. The generic scenario is that the expectation values of a quantum theory do not behave exactly the same way as the classical value. But they're not completely different either. I mean, let's think about it. Why is it that the quantum theory has slightly different evolution than the classical theory? Remember, the classical theory has as its equations of motion, or has as its evolution, classical solution, it's the path of extremal action. Okay? ds by dx is equal to zero. That's the path of extremal action. In the quantum field theory, we are summing the path integral over all possible paths, not just the extremal action ones, but all possible ones. And what that means is that the quantum theory explores not just the classical path of extremal action, but also quantum fluctuations around it. That's why, in general, the evolution of a quantum system is somewhat different than that of a classical system. This has led people to study the concept of effective action, the quantum effective action. And it works like this. The classical action gives you the classical theory, fine. But you can ask, which modified action, if you treated it as if it was a classical one, would give you the correct quantum evolution? Right? So you're basically calculating which terms do you have to add to the action so that you now get that the classical motion is actually the quantum motion. Right? So the classical motion of the quantum effective action is actually the quantum motion of the expectation value. This is of interest if what you want to know is how do quantum fluctuations change the dynamics of a theory? To calculate these so-called counterterms that arise because of quantum fluctuations. So Sacharov in 1968 said that quantum effects of matter always induce extra terms in the action, and in particular, some of these terms will be the Einstein action, and therefore induce the Einstein equation. So here's Sacharov's reasoning. Let's assume that the classical deterministic evolution of matter obeys the usual equations of motion, right? So this would be the Dirac equation, the Maxwell equations, and so on. But quantum theory allows every evolution to happen virtually, just like if you don't observe where a particle travels through a double slit, it takes both slits, right? It's a virtual evolution where both paths are possible. And that is just a very, very special case of what quantum theory does in general. Whenever you don't observe an evolution, that is to say, between two experiments, the system will undergo all evolutions, all at once. And it will have probability amplitudes for each one of these evolutions. If you are interested in that particular thing, I recommend to you very, very highly to look up the first 20 pages or so of the book by Feynman and Hibbs. Feynman, Hibbs, Quantum Mechanics and Path Integrals. It's just ingenious. It's super clearly explained how this comes about. Namely that basically quantum mechanics means that between measurements, when we don't observe, so between two measurements, probability theory is modified. And instead of having probabilities, we have probability amplitude. And every evolution can happen with a probability amplitude. The probability amplitude being e to the power I times the action of that particular evolution that we are considering at the moment. So if you're not familiar with this, the first thing to read about this particular thing is Feynman and Hibbs. It's written by Feynman. Can't get better explanations than that. And then, as usual in quantum theory, the actual evolution, including the quantum effects, is not completely different from the evolution that you would have classically. That's why we don't see big quantum effects in daily life, right? Everything is quantum, and yet it appears pretty classical, and that's because the quantum effective actions are typically very close to the ordinary action, to the classical action. Remember, the quantum effective action being an action, it looks like a regular action, but we have added terms such that if you naively calculate the equations of motion, it will actually be describing the equation of motion of the expectation values of the quantum theory. All right, here in black, I just wrote what I already told you about the path integral and that you should read Feynman and Hibbs. All right. So what this means is this. If you pick up a book on particle physics, quantum field theory book on particle physics, you will find the action, the classical action, which will have the action for electromagnetism, the Higgs field, which is a scalar field, and then neutrinos, and you know all sorts of particles, electrons, and so on. That's the classical action. At the beginning, they will typically show you a page of terms, and that these are the terms of the classical action of the standard model. But then if you browse through the book, you will see that this action accumulates extra terms. As you renormalize the theory, as you take into account the quantum effects, as you do a perturbative expansion of your theory, and you take into account loop calculations and all that stuff, which is just to say you do the quantum theory of this classical action. And then towards the end of the book, if you have a good book, you will find statements about the quantum effective action, which tells you how that original classical action is modified by the quantum effects, such that if you now take the quantum effective action and treat it as if it was a classical action, you will get equations of motion that are the equations of motion for the quantum expectation values. So, the aim then is, Zaharov said, let us look at the effective action of the standard model of particle physics, just conventional quantum field theory of the conventional kinds of particles. And we do the usual renormalization, we get the usual counter terms, the usual extra terms that are being induced because of the quantum fluctuations to take into account that the equations of motion are a little bit different. But as opposed to the usual textbook stuff, we now do this not on Minkowski space, we do it in curved space-time. We allow there to be a non-trivial metric. This changes the game a little bit. Because now we still get all the usual counterterms plus more counterterms. Because now that we have the metric in there, we can also have counterterms that involve the metric. Now, these calculations are super difficult, can you imagine, because you have to do perturbation theory with dozens of fields and lots of difficult integrals and all that. However, you can make statements that are very generic, that hold true very generally. One of the statements is this. As you do these calculations, as you calculate the impact of quantum fluctuations on the evolution of the expectation values of fields, the kind of thing that we do next term, by the way, a little bit. You're not going to renormalize the standard model. No need for that. Okay, so, but a very general statement you can make is that as you do these calculations, there will be integrals that are divergent as you take the limit of short distances. Or if you work in momentum space, it's when you take your integration all the way to infinite momenta. So there are going to be divergent quantities in there. But on the other hand, we don't know whether there are arbitrarily large momenta in nature. Should we really push the momentum in this integral, in these integrals to infinity? Imagine if you had a box that had some energy in it, and you take the limit for that energy going to infinity. That doesn't really make sense. Right? Imagine if this thing would collapse to a black hole, and then it would get heavier and heavier, and it would just attract everything extremely. The limit for an energy going to infinity is nonsense. It cannot go to infinity, really. And similarly, for momentum, but also if vice versa via Fourier transform, that limit corresponds to the distance is going to arbitrarily small, there's no reason to believe that the notion of distances that are arbitrarily small actually makes sense. But it is in that limit that we have divergences in the integrals. So what do we do? What we do is we introduce a cutoff. We simply cut those integrals off. We don't really know what physics happens there where we do the cutoff, but we know that the physics we know comes to an end there. So we just integrate as far as we think we understand the physics. So we introduce a cutoff in these integrals. Remember, which integrals? We are quantizing the standard model, quantum field theory of the standard model. Right? We work out all those integrals, they come out infinite, but we put a cutoff there, a smallest length or a largest momentum. They are reciprocal to each other. So either maximum momentum, h bar over L, c for cutoff, or a smallest length scale, L, c. Also a smallest time scale, right? Because we have space and time integrals. So there's a maximum momentum, maximum energy, and smallest length, smallest time. At this point is where quantum gravity theories usually kick in. You know, string theorists would say, okay, I have a guess for what happens beyond that. It's really strings, blah, blah. Or some other quantum gravity theory, they would say, okay, quantum field theory up until then, but then some other thing they make up. Okay? But let's be agnostic along with Sarov and just say, all we know is that we can integrate this far. And then who knows what happened? Maybe nothing. We have no evidence either way. So we put the cutoff there, we calculate all of this stuff, and then as always in quantum theory, the effective action will contain terms of all possible forms that are consistent with the symmetries of the theory. That is to say, that are consistent with the covariance of the theory. Now, what does that mean? It means, for example, that if you take the Maxwell equations and the Dirac equation, so that you have electrons interacting with photons, you get counterterms of all sorts. Now, if you're lucky, a lot of these counterterms will actually come with prefactors that are zero. And if you're really lucky, it might be that you only get a finite number of counterterms and the rest is all zero. That happens in a renormalizable theory. Now, why would we want that there are not infinitely many counterterms? See, if there are infinitely many counterterms, then they come with coefficients in front of them. that you have to determine experimentally. If this is 5 coefficients, you do 5 experiments. If it's 50 coefficients, you do 50 experiments. But if it's infinitely many, then you will never be done. Okay? Now, the standard model of particle physics is fine. We only have a finite number of them. And so it can be renormalized. And anyway, Suvorov wasn't so much interested in the renormalizability or non-renormalizability of quantum field theory. He was interested in gravity. And he said, okay, so the standard model of particle physics acquires, I mean, the quantum effective action of the standard model of particle physics acquires lots of counterterms. And they are typically benign. Actually, all of them are benign, can be handled. But what about gravity? And he said, look, what can we have? What can possibly be the shape of the quantum effective action of the standard model of particle physics? How can it possibly look like? Remember, we have not introduced gravity yet. We've only allowed space-time to be curved. So we have the action of the standard model. So just electrons, neutrinos, the stuff that we know to be particles. And then Suvorov said, look, the action, the quantum effective action, has to look like this. It has to be the matter, the classical Lagrangian of the matter fields, the thing that we started out with. Right? The classical action of the matter fields. So the classical action of the electromagnetism, of the Dirac particles like neutrinos and electrons and so on, and quarks, plus there will be the matter effective action. So these will be matter terms, stuff that involves photons, gluons, quarks, and so on, extra terms that come about because of the quantum effects, of quantum fluctuations. These terms, together with those, allow us to describe the evolution of the expectation values of fields in the standard model as if it was classical, but with the quantum effects taken into account. Right? Just like a quantum anharmonic oscillator has a slightly different motion of its expectation values than the classical anharmonic oscillator would have. And the difference are these terms. Okay, but then Suvorov said, since the action contains all the matter fields and the metric, and they can come, and the counter terms generically can be any term that does not violate symmetries, we should expect that there is a term which is simply C1 times the volume form, because why not? It's totally symmetric. It's totally consistent with the symmetries of the theory. Therefore, quantum fluctuations will generically induce this. And then another term, we have the Ricci scalar, which, remember, is the only linear term, linear scalar you can create from the Riemann curvature tensor. If you contract the indices differently, you get zero. So we have the Ricci scalar multiplied with some coefficient. You see, this is a coefficient that we don't know. We have to calculate that from the quantum fluctuations in the standard model. Here, too, we know that there's going to be some counter term of the form some number times the Ricci scalar. C2 has to be calculated from the standard model, from its actual renormalization theory. And then C3 times some terms of order curvature squared, and then higher order curvature terms, and it will never end. In principle, it will never end. And in practice, it also never ends. We have good reason to believe that this sequence does not end, which means that gravity is not renormalizable. In principle, you have to determine an infinite number of coefficients to write down what the true gravity action is. But as we will see soon, it turns out that this term is huge. This term is a nice size. This term is heavily suppressed. And all the higher order terms are insanely heavily suppressed. So even though there are a lot of them, and we would need to measure their coefficients, etc., not really much of a concern. Maybe at the origin of a singularity, like a black hole singularity, or at the origin of the universe, Big Bang singularity, maybe there the initial terms matter because the curvature can be tremendously large. But in regular circumstances, those terms will not contribute. Okay, so Sakharov argued that because the standard model has quantum fluctuations, once you quantize it, there will be counterterms, and so the quantum effective action will take this form, where these are new terms introduced. Okay? So now we can go ahead and calculate the equation of motion for the metric now. Now we take this quantum effective action, where we've taken into account the quantum fluctuations of the standard model fields, and differentiate it with respect to the metric. We will do that in a moment. Let me just anticipate what we should see. If you differentiate this stuff, you get the energy momentum tensor, right? Because this is just the matter. This is the matter field. This would be the classical matter. This is with the quantum effects. If you differentiate with respect to the metric, you get the energy momentum tensor. If you differentiate with respect to the metric these extra terms, you get extra stuff. And it turns out it's some extra tensor that you get over there. We'll get to that exactly. And then you set this equal to zero. You say ds by dg equal to zero. So energy momentum tensor plus some other stuff equal to zero, and that will be the Einstein equation. Okay, so what Sakharov showed is that even if you start out writing a theory that doesn't have any action for gravity, so none of this stuff, the standard model of particle physics is generating it through quantum fluctuations, unavoidably. Now, he also provided a little intuition for why that would be. All I've said so far is that, yeah, it has to do with quantum fluctuations. But there is a better way to see this, too. Imagine you take a crystal. What you have in a crystal is nuclei that have a certain regular distance pattern to them, and they are sitting there in their equilibrium positions, and they wiggle harmonically about that. And then, so what we have is a bunch of coupled harmonic oscillators. That's how you can describe a crystal in a good approximation. Now imagine you take that crystal, which could be, I don't know, a bar of metal, and now you twist it. You give it some twist like that. It will resist this, and if you let go, it will snap back. And it might even vibrate a little bit like this, right? Or you take a hammer and you just tap it, and then there will be a sound going through, which is really a deformation wave that goes through it, which means that, yes, it will be deformed, but it will resist that and snap back and then oscillate, right? What is this? Fundamentally, what's going on is this. Remember that the quantum harmonic oscillator has, as its ground state energy, 1/2 h bar omega. Now, in a crystal, you have lots of harmonic oscillators, and they are coupled to each other. Each nucleus can oscillate around its equilibrium position, but it feels its neighbors. It's coupled to them. So you have a bunch of coupled harmonic oscillators. Now, you may know, I hope you do know, that whenever you have a system of coupled harmonic oscillators, and it doesn't matter how many, there's always a change of variables such that you get an equal number of uncoupled harmonic oscillators, so-called normal modes. And that's very convenient to change to these new coordinates. So instead of the old x and p variables, you get new q and k variables that are linear combinations of the old x and p's. And these new harmonic oscillators in the q and the k variables are independent harmonic oscillators. And then you find out what their frequencies are, and you can calculate what their ground state energy is, you know, 1/2 h bar omega from each one of those harmonic oscillators, and you get the ground state energy of the crystal. Now, what happens when you deform that? You take your bar of metal and you twist it. Now, the equilibrium positions of your harmonic oscillators, the equilibrium positions of your nuclei, a little bit displaced. So the entire coupling of these harmonic oscillators changes. If you now want to do a change of variables to the normal modes, that are independent harmonic oscillators, non-coupled harmonic oscillators, you will have to do slightly different transformation. And you get that the normal modes are slightly having slightly different frequencies, which means that the ground state energies, 1/2 h bar omega, is slightly different. And it is higher. The total sum of it is higher. So as you deform the crystal, you're raising the energy, the ground state energy of this bunch of harmonic oscillators. That's why the crystal doesn't like it. You are actually lifting it to a higher energetic state. So if you let go, it will snap back, right? And it will start oscillating. And what Sakharov showed is that for space-time, you can use the same picture. While for a crystal, it is phonons, quantized sound waves, that propagate pressure waves or deformation waves. For space-time, it would be phonons. But in principle, it's the same thing. Whenever you have a quantum field on space-time, it's very much a continuous version of this business of harmonic oscillators that are coupled to each other. If you take the Klein-Gordon equation and you discretize space-time, you get exactly what I was describing about harmonic oscillators in a crystal, coupled harmonic oscillators. And so as you change the shape of your space-time, you get that these harmonic oscillators couple a little bit differently. And so the ground state energies sum up to a different sum. That's why space-time resists deformation. That's why we have gravitational waves. Okay. Anyway, that was just the intuition that that Sakharov came up with, namely to say that gravitons are the phonons of space-time. All right. So what about these coefficients, C1, etc.? Oh, there we go. So here's the quantum effective action of the standard model of particle physics if space-time is allowed to be curved. Well, then we have these extra terms with coefficients C1, C2, C3, which are just numbers. But what would they be, these numbers? Let's estimate what these numbers should be. Okay, what do they depend, the C1, C2, etc.? Well, they depend on the details of the matter action. It depends on what kind of particles we have, because that will affect the integrals we have to do. And also, bosons and fermions tend to contribute with opposite signs to these things. If, for example, we had complete so-called supersymmetry, which means that every boson has a fermion sister and vice versa, then it turns out that the first term would actually vanish, because these contributions would just go away. The C1 would vanish. But we don't have full supersymmetry. We probably don't have any supersymmetry. Okay. Then it also depends on the order of the perturbation theory, how far we do the calculation. And it depends, and that's very important, on the value of the short distance cutoff. Remember that our integrals would come out infinite. But we cut them off. We say no length shorter than this. Now, how big can we choose the shortest length to be in this integral without running into difficulties with observation? For example, if we make the cutoff at a kilometer, would that be good? No, we have wavelengths shorter than a kilometer, right? We know that for sure. So we could choose our smallest wavelength, LC, to be maybe, I don't know, millimeter? No, we have wavelengths that are way shorter than that, right? We have like light, for example. Typical light, you know, blue light has what? The wavelength of, I don't know, 400, 500 nanometers or something. 400 or so. So definitely we have wavelengths of nanometers, but we can go way further. You know, gamma rays, X-rays, I mean X-rays and then gamma rays. Very short wavelengths. The shortest wavelengths we can generate at the LHC with super high energetic particles. And the wavelengths that we get there are about 10 to the minus 20 meters. So we could say LC is 10 to the minus 22 meters. And if we do that, if we cut off the integrals there, we would be perfectly consistent with observation. But we don't know why it would be 10 to the minus 22 meters. It could be anything, anything smaller than that, because we haven't explored smaller distances yet. OK, so now, let's look at the action again. You see, C1 has different units from C2, different units from C3, because they have different powers of the curvature tensor in it. And overall, the whole thing needs to be integrated over space and then give us a dimensionless quantity. In fact, strictly speaking, a quantity of the dimensions of an action, which is the same as h bar. So you can work out what the units have to be of C1, C2, and C3. And for the unit full quantity, we have, of course, our cutoff. So what we have is that C1, the coefficient in front of the first counter term, is going to be some number that needs to be calculated, but it's dimensionless, just a number, times, in order to make the units come out right, it has to be the cutoff length to the power minus 4. And then C2 has to be some number that needs to be determined, times the cutoff length to the power minus 2, etc. Now, if, for example, the cutoff length is 10 to the minus 22 meters, this is 10 to the minus 88 meters to the 4. And this, on the other hand, if we're talking about, plus 88, right? And that would be a very small number, because there we take 10 to the minus 22 to the square. If we put the cutoff at 10 to the minus 22 meters, we have no reason to do it at that value or another value. We will soon get a reason to do it at a particular value. Okay, so for small cutoff lengths, which is what we have to do not to be in contradiction to observations, what we have is that C1 is way bigger than C2, way bigger than C3, way bigger than C4, etc. Simply because if LC is a small length, then take it to the fourth power and you get a huge number. Whereas if you take LC, a small length, and square, you get a tiny number. Like this would be 10 to the minus 44. This is 10 to the plus 88. So we would expect that this number is tiny, and that number is huge. Now, these have to be calculated, and they will depend on the details of the standard model of particle physics. But generally, we have no reason to believe these numbers should come out very large or very small, because they come about from just combining pi's and square root of 2's and that sort of thing in the calculations. OK, so now let's look at the very lowest order terms. We have the effective action, the quantum effective action of the standard model of particle physics. And then we have the C1 term and we have the C2 term. I threw away the other terms because remember the C3, C4 are already very, very much suppressed. I will tell you in a moment what exactly the values of C1 and C2 are. For now, we can already calculate what the equations of motion for the metric are if the action, the total action, is this one, which is the matter action, quantum effective action of matter, plus a constant, not really just a constant, it's also multiplied with square root of g in order to get covariance, and this term here. This term is called the Einstein action, just the Ricci scalar. And then this term, you also know already, it's the cosmological constant. Right? So Sakharov's argument tells us that the standard model of particle physics, when quantized, generates for you a cosmological constant, which is going to be huge. We will see in a moment how large. And it will generate the Einstein action, and therefore the Einstein equations, as we will see, and other terms that are super tiny. How? Well, we just differentiate the quantum effective action, the total quantum effective action with respect to the metric, set that equal to zero. The equation of motion that we now get is the equation of motion for the metric, and that's going to be the Einstein equation. So Einstein postulated the exact same action principle, but he didn't know that it came from quantum field theory, because in 1916, there was no quantum field theory. They were just about to discover quantum theory a few years later. Okay, so what this means is something that I think is important to keep in mind. If you are interested in quantum gravity, and somebody gives a talk and tells you that they have come up with a fantastic new theory of quantum gravity, which has the tremendous benefit that in the low energy limit, it will give you ordinary Einstein gravity, then you should say, well, yeah, of course it did. It had no other way. You see, because any theory, any candidate theory for quantum gravity that you may cook up, has the property that if it reduces to quantum field theory at low energies, it also reduces to general relativity. Because quantum field theory generates general relativity. You just have to allow space-time to be curved, and quantum field theory will generate the right action and therefore the right equations of motion of gravity. So gravity is a given. It doesn't have to be rederived. Once you have quantum field theory in a low energy limit on a curved space-time, you get gravity. Here's a review paper on the subject. Okay, so now, what are the equations of motion for the metric? Let us look at the action principle. The action principle is we differentiate now the effective action, which is not only the effective action of the matter fields, but it's the effective action that includes those extra counter terms that the matter fields induce, the metric ones, the cosmological constant and the Einstein term. So we set the derivative with respect to g of this equal to zero, which is to say that the following has to be zero, that the following has to be true. ds by dg has two types of terms. One is coming from the matter action and the other one from the extra cosmological constant and Einstein term. And the derivative with respect to the derivative of the matter action with respect to the metric gives us the energy momentum tensor as we developed earlier, right? Differentiate the action of matter with respect to the metric and you get the energy momentum tensor. Now we have two more terms in the action, namely those two. So we have to differentiate those two terms also with respect to the metric. That's what we do here. So in total we have this plus that is equal to zero, which is this equation here. All right. So the right-hand side we already calculated, it's the energy-momentum tensor. The left-hand side we still have to calculate. We have to differentiate this term with respect to the metric. Why is that not zero? The constant, after all. Yeah. It's not zero because it multiplies the square root of g. Okay? Right. And then we have to differentiate this term with respect to g and that term with respect to g. And that term, and these multiply those terms, right? Okay, so we have to calculate all of these things. And in the interest of time, I wrote out all the details of it, and there are really no new tricks in this. So tedious. Okay, so we're working out the various variations here of the Ricci tensor and so on. And then we throw away a boundary term. You've seen that happen before, right? But I would really suggest you look through this. It's not impenetrable. You can do this. Then at the end, after lots of calculations, you bring the various pieces together and you find that this is what we get. So we find that the variation of this here, which is the cosmological constant term and the Ricci scalar, remember that's just R, right? R mu contracted with G mu is R, the Ricci scalar. The variation of that with respect to the metric is given by this expression here. Cosmological constant and the so-called Einstein tensor, where the Einstein tensor was probably, here it is. This expression comes up in these calculations, and that expression, the Ricci tensor minus the Ricci scalar times the metric, it's 1/2 metric, is, because this combination comes up all the time, is given its own name, and it's called the Einstein tensor. So, after doing this differentiation of the action, the gravitational part of the action with respect to the metric, we bring everything together and we find that the variation of the gravitational action is given by cosmological constant term, Einstein action term. Now we can put everything together. Namely, we can now write down what this is. If we take the full action, quantum effective action of all the standard model particle fields, and we let the quantum effect induce counter terms both for the matter fields and for gravity, then That action, we differentiate with respect to the metric, set that equal to zero, and then this is the equation that we get. This is the Einstein equation. If we spell it out fully, this is what it is. And it's still written out in those coefficients that we had obtained from Sacharov's argument. C1 was the coefficient in front of the cosmological constant, C2 was the coefficient in front of the Einstein action. Now, when you do comparison with experiment, I mean, this is a claim. Einstein claimed this describes nature. But he also didn't know what the coefficients here should be. Right? I mean, what should be the coefficients C1 and C2? He didn't know. So what he did is, he assumed for a start that the coefficient C1, that multiplies the cosmological constant, is zero. He thought that that was a blunder, right? So he assumed this to be zero, in which case that term was absent. And you only have to fix what C2 is. And you can do that by making a prediction for an experiment. And he did for the perihelion, rotation of the perihelion of Mercury, at the same time that Hilbert tried to do it. But Einstein was faster. Anyway, the answer is that in order to get the correct perihelion shift of Mercury, C2 has to be this value, where g is the Newton constant. And of course, you get all of the rest of gravity as well. But the point was that it would not only, with this choice of C2, you're not just reproducing, you know, the speed with which an apple falls from a tree, or the evolution on the trajectory, you're also reproducing, or you're also predicting correctly the perihelion shift of Mercury. All right, so now we have C2 experimentally fixed. We can now write the Einstein equation again. Now it looks like this. Here's the Einstein tensor again. Then here's the cosmological constant, the C1. Einstein assumed at first it was zero. At first he thought it was non-zero. And then he thought it was zero, and then nobody was sure, and now we think it is non-zero. So there's the cosmological constant term, and then there is this term with the energy momentum tensor. So in order to make this thing completely explicit, we have to figure out what is lambda. What is the value of C1, the term that multiplies the counter term that produces the cosmological constant? Well, we can do that if we can find what LC is, what the cutoff length is. It turns out that because we have C2, we can work that out. You see, we know that 1 over 16 pi g is C2. Right? That came from experiment, perihelion shift, and so on. So the C2, however, was also this number valued, I mean, this number of order 1, something made out of square roots of 2 and pi and stuff like that, times LC to the power minus 2. So from that we obtain that LC, if we solve this equation for LC, we obtain it is lambda 2 times the square root of 16 pi g. If we undo the usual convention of setting h pi equal to 1 and c equal to 1, if we plug back in the numbers and the constants and everything, this is what we get. If the cutoff length is square root of 16 pi h bar g over c, plug in the numbers. And what you get is this number here. The lambda 2, remember, is in some number of order 1. So what we get is that the cutoff length is this, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 35 meters. Let me translate that into a shortcut statement. It means that in order for Sakharov's argument to work, in order for quantum field theory to produce exactly the Einstein action as a counterterm, the cutoff length in nature needs to be the Planck length, 10 to the minus 35 meters. This is what it says. Except for some stuff of order 1. Okay, now that we have LC, we can calculate the size of all of the quantities. Now we can calculate C1. C2 we had already from the Perihelion shift. Now we can also calculate C3, C4, etc. What do we expect? What do we, no, not expect, what do we calculate? Okay, I said this already. When quantum field theories are cut off at the Planck length, then they induce Einstein gravity with the correct equations of motion and coupling strength. Exactly the right coefficient. However, this fixed our cutoff length, LC, to be the Planck length. Now, what does that mean for the coefficient C1? So the coefficient C1 is some number of order 1 times LC to the power minus 4. LC is this. We have to take this to the power of minus 4. So that means that Zakharov would predict that quantum field theory produces a cosmological constant which is, has this size. Just plugging in the numbers, it's 10 to the 70 over meter squared. Now, the cosmological constant has a gravitational impact. As we will see later in the course, the larger the cosmological constant, the faster the universe wants to expand. If there was only a cosmological constant, the universe would expand exponentially fast. All right, so we can measure the cosmological constant. There's positive evidence for the existence of a cosmological constant. And that value, you can look up. People got Nobel Prize for this. The trouble is, what we predicted is completely off. It's 10 to the 70 per meter squared. That would be the theoretical prediction from quantum field theory. And what does experiment say? Well, experiment says it's 10 to the minus 52. You see, this is how far they are apart. The lambda according to the theory is 10 to the 70. The lambda according to experiment is 10 to the minus 52. We are off by 122 orders of magnitude. That's pretty bad. Now, some people engage in numerology and they say, where in nature does a number like 10 to the minus 22 come up naturally? I think it comes up naturally in string theory. You know how? I think it's about the probability that 10 to the minus 122 is about the probability that string theory describes nature. So maybe there is some connection there. Who knows? Anyway. Okay, so for some unknown reason, the constant part, C1, of the vacuum energy of quantum field theories does essentially not gravitate. It's a tiny amount of cosmological constant compared to what we would expect theoretically. Now, we did a relatively rough argument. We did argue that there is some number in there of order 1. It might not be of order 1, but could it be of order 10? 122? Probably not. Anyway, we don't really know what's going on at scales as small as 10 to the minus 35 meters, so everything is pretty wide open there. But what is definitely clear is that on one hand, quantum field theory beautifully induces general relativity through its quantum fluctuations. The action is modified, the equations of motion are modified in such a way that it produces just the extra terms that gravity also predicts. Quantum field theory also predicts higher order terms in the curvature, but they would be even more suppressed. Remember, the cosmological constant term is the first term, huge. Then comes the Einstein action, normal. Right? And there are dozens and dozens of orders of magnitude in between. And then the next term, quadratic in the curvature tensor, would be suppressed by dozens and dozens of orders of magnitude in the higher order terms as well. All right, so for some unknown reason, the constant part, the cosmological constant, somehow doesn't seem to gravitate. It's either not there, or at least it doesn't gravitate. Right. So now we have the Einstein equation, and for the rest of the course, we will solve it.
Has anyone calculated any other constants, like C3, C4, and found that they blow up or that they
Yeah, they become super small.
So
super
they're
small. Yes, if you remember, we can actually look at this. Here. You see, C1 goes like the cutoff length to the power minus 4. If the cutoff length is 10 to the minus 35 meters, then 10 to the minus 35 to the power 4 is plus 10 to the 40. Huge. And then this is only 10 to the minus 35 squared. That's 10 to the 70. And then that is just the length itself. And then down here we have 10 to the minus 35. So it's just order 1, I mean in lengths of LC. And then we have here LC squared. It's 10 to the minus 35 squared. It's 10 to the minus 70. So if you compare, for example, this term to that term, it's like 70 orders of magnitude smaller than that. And that one is 70 orders of magnitude smaller than that. That one is 70 orders of magnitude smaller than that. It's 70 orders of magnitude each time. And we can't measure any number with 70 digits of accuracy. This one we get with great accuracy. That one is just insanely too large. And this one is predicted to be super small. And indeed, we have no evidence for the presence of quadratic curvature terms or even higher order curvature terms. Of course, the actual numerical values here would have to be worked out. Nobody knows. All right? Any questions?
I wonder when you're actually integrating C1 over all the space-time, is there any problem with integrating a constant over something infinite?
Remember that we are calculating the Euler Lagrange equations. And we do that by doing a variation. We differentiate with respect to changes of the metric or changes of the matter fields, always in regions. Right? So we always do that in regions, and then say outside we are no longer varying. Also, the derivatives vanish, and so you're right. In principle, the action is infinite, but the derivatives are fine. And you could always also just, you know, put your universe into a large box. I mean, you could in principle put cutoff there, and either by hand by putting a boundary, which would be very unphysical, or you could also assume that the universe is actually closed, so that it would have a finite volume without having boundaries, like the surface of a sphere. No boundaries, but still a finite area.
I find it maybe we'd have to compare the relative sizes of LC to the minus 4 and L1 and the other terms, unitless instead of in terms of a unit.
Well, you see, in principle, I mean, basically that's what we do. You see, the C1, C2, C3, C4 are the quantities that arise from Sakharov's principle. They are the quantities that arise as the counter terms. And then we decompose them into a unitful part and a unitless part. Right? And then the unitless part is basically arrived at from working out certain coefficients of these integrals. And then the asymptotic behavior of the integrals and the units that they carry are carried in here. And so we are separating the unitful scaling behavior from the unitless overall factors.
Do people know that factor? Can you work it out?
Which one?
The values of the lattice?
Yes, you can. For very simple theories, you can do it. And you also know that very simple supersymmetric theories would have this zero, for example. Yeah. Yeah, it's dramatic, right? So many orders of magnitude. But this is what happens when you put gravity and quantum theory together. We obviously don't know yet how to combine them. All right. I see you on Friday.